Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the world of wildlife. And Scott Craven is back with us, an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. We'll talk with him about some wildlife encounters. We'll talk turtles and frogs, the end of the spring turkey hunt, and, of course, take your questions and comments as well. And I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email and maybe even a wildlife photo to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Scott Craven, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Larry, and listeners, it's great to be back. I've been up in northern Wisconsin for quite a stint, and it's good to be home for a little while.
Yeah, I just got back from week. I played in a golf tournament in Saskatchewan last week, and one of the little stories I have is we finished one of the holes, and we were walking off, and a cinnamon bear, pretty big one, maybe 350, 400-pounder, came right up along the edge of the green.
that will get your attention.
That got my attention, and the group behind us that was following us had to kind of wait for the bear to leave before they could hit onto the green. And it's, you know, of course, that was in a provincial park, and, you know, one of their big national parks, and so the animals can roam free in there. But there are some reports recently about some scary wildlife encounters right here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I think the one that attracted the most attention was the bear that leaped through a window up in northern Wisconsin in Taylor County and got into a basically hand-to-hand combat with the husband and wife in the house, and eventually, after everybody sustained a few injuries, the bear was subdued and killed in the house. And that's a very unusual circumstance. And as you mentioned, you would expect it to attract a lot of attention, and it has. But it's not something, much like your encounter and thousands of other bear encounters that end peacefully with people being thrilled to see a bear. This is a very unusual circumstance, and hard to explain. The bear may have been startled. He was the husband was apparently hollering at the bear through an open window to get it away from a bird feeder. It was a female. There was a cub outside. You know, who knows what stimulated the bear to leap the wrong way, but it was not a good ending for anybody.
Yeah. And there are some other ones going on. Trina LaSusa was commenting to me about birds attacking.
there was actually a big article in the Madison newspaper this morning about people being on the alert for nesting birds, protecting their territory, nest, eggs, young, and so forth. And blackbirds, red-winged blackbirds, were singled out and can be very aggressive and actually strike people, usually in the back of the head as they're walking, biking, or moving somewhere near the bird's territory. And it can be startling. It can be painful. It can actually draw blood. And under circumstances where perhaps you're biking or, you know, in an awkward mid-step or something, it could result in a fall and more substantial injury. So you need to be a little cautious this time of year, especially if you're in an area where you know the birds are nesting or you see the birds around. Be careful.
be careful is a good way to put it. We were really careful around that bear, I can tell you that. We did not attempt to scare the bear away.
You had a 3-iron in each hand, though.
I did have an iron in my hand just in case, but I was keeping my distance, and the bear wasn't paying any attention. The bear was eating and enjoying his dinner. Somebody said, well, I guess he wanted to play through the course. Oh, man. Well, the turkey season just ended. How'd it go?
Last time I was on, we talked a little bit about the turkey season was in its early stages then, but I mentioned that there were growing numbers of reports and concerns that hunters were not hearing as many turkeys or seeing as many turkeys as they expected to, wanted to, or normally did. And that was causing a bit of concern. And, that didn't really change much during the season. But, of course, those reports of people disgruntled by not seeing as many turkeys as they thought they should were also tempered by plenty of reports of people, you know, bagging nice gobblers or having a great hunt. So there are still plenty of turkeys out there, and some hunters are having good success. But there is growing concern nationwide over slow decline in turkey populations. And at this point, I've not heard any very satisfying explanations of what's going on. But it's gotten more people's attention, and people who are responsible for turkey management are paying some attention now. We'll see what shapes up over the next couple of years. Mm.
Sherry in Elkhorn has a question for you. Let's go there. Sherry, hi.
Hi. We have some kind of a creature that's dug a hole underneath our sidewalk that butts up against the porch on the front porch.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And we have, like, tried to fill it in, and it keeps digging it back out. We've tried sprinkling some of the deterrents and spraying things, and to no avail. And so we think that's working, and then we fill it up, and now we have a smaller hole that's going underneath there, which makes me wonder if it's a bunny, only because the hole was bigger before. So
how big is the hole?
Well, right now it's about 4x4 inches. It had been quite big before.
Like twice as big?
Yeah, at least, if not maybe a little bigger.
Okay. And, well, it's probably not, Sherry, it's probably not a bunny. That issue, now that's not to say that a rabbit wouldn't take up residence in a hole or burrow dug by something else, like a woodchuck, which is one of our best primary excavators. But rabbits don't do a whole lot of digging on their own and would not be bold enough to keep reopening anything anyway right there on your sidewalk. So given the fact that the hole started out pretty large and the digger was very persistent and apparently reasonably powerful, I'd still suggest a woodchuck is your primary culprit. And if you finally discouraged it with all your activity, that something else certainly could have taken up residence. Oh, look, an abandoned home. We'll take over here. That could have been a rabbit, a chipmunk, or several other things. But I think what started things out was probably a woodchuck. And where it is now or whether it's going to keep digging remains to be seen. But what kinds of, you said you used some deterrents. What kinds of things were you putting in the hole?
We weren't, you know, sprinkling things, you know, like what's the name of that stuff that we were sprinkling in the hole? Mole and gopher repellent. We have, something called animal stopper, garden animal repellent that we sprayed, and then something else that was, we used it up.
I'm not sure what the active ingredient is in some of those commercial products, but the two things that are the two common household products that are most discouraging to animals that are digging or in a confined space are naphthalene flakes, moth flakes, and ammonia. And a little household ammonia saturated in a rag and stuffed down a hole, or a handful of moth flakes are usually pretty discouraging to most mammals. So if it's still around, you could try something like that. If that's not working, then I'd suggest that at least for the time being, until the animal relocates, that you get yourself a section of wire fencing, either 2x2 welded wire or some other type of 4-foot wide fencing, and lay it down over the area so it extends obviously a couple feet on either side, and see if that puts an end to it. Then you can just pick it up and move on. If you really want to know what's going on, either get a hold of, borrow, or whatever, a trail camera, a scouting camera, game camera, whatever you want to call it, that they're widely used now, and set it up so it'll capture an image of whatever is visiting that site. Then you'll know who you're up against. So that might help a little bit if you knew who the culprit was for sure.
Jerry, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Kent in Reedstown, it's your turn. Hi, Kent.
Yeah, hi. I'm wondering how a little land turtle, like a box turtle, finds its mate when everything's a jungle, the grass and little turtle running through the grass. How does that work?
Well, that's a good question, Kent. And the reality is that we as humans are often amazed by the feats of many different kinds of animals in terms of moving through what we perceive as an impenetrable barrier or long distance or whatever. And there are plenty of examples, not just a turtle that's a member of a fairly, box turtle, a fairly uncommon species. And then you know, they have to get together for mating and finding suitable places to hibernate and so on, but they do it and they survive and they've been doing it for many, 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 many years. But you think about other circumstances. I live up on a bit of high ground, nowhere near any water, and yet all types of frogs make their way to the water garden that I have in the backyard. And my house is surrounded by 10 acres of restored prairie, and it really is jungle-like. You know, if a turtle at least has a little protection in the form of a hard shell and claws and can move through something. But what about a frog with its thin skin and so forth? Yet they get here, and they get here every year, and different species. Or think about a snake having to find its hibernaculum, the place where it spends the winter, and moving across the landscape through fields and crop fields and fence rows and everything else, when its field of vision is about, at best, an inch or so off the ground, and yet these animals may move several miles over the landscape to find that rock formation or whatever that they use to overwinter. So some use scent, in the case of the snakes, for example. Some apparently just rely on random chance, but they also are capable of using senses like birds migrating, for example, that we as humans don't have and wonder at or marvel at. And that's one of the cool things about wildlife is that they're capable of doing things like finding their way back from migration thousands of miles away or finding their way across the landscape to find a mate or a food source or a favorite wintering spot or whatever. They do it, and they do it very well, and the payoff is that they survive. So.
Yeah, Kent.
Long answer, but it's a bunch of amazing stuff, and it keeps us wondering and keeps us interested in these animals, which is a good thing.
Yeah. Anything? Somebody else wondered about what's going on with turtles this time of the year.
Well, this of course is the period of activity for turtles when they're moving across the landscape, mostly females looking for a nest site to lay their eggs. On a road cut back or cut a road bank or a gravelly area, sandy area, usually traditionally where they've nested before. So they're moving long distances across the landscape. They're single-minded. They're not easy to deter from that mission. And as a result, as they move to and fro, they're out and about where people encounter them, unfortunately, often on roadways. And this is the time of year, as I was driving back from northern Wisconsin or driving around in northern Wisconsin the last couple of weeks, I began to see substantial numbers of snapping turtles. I assume the painted turtles will be out and about soon and probably are in some areas. And the tricky part there is what we can do as people, as drivers, you know, hikers, bikers, or whatever, when encountering a turtle on that nesting mission. And that usually involves trying to help them get across a road in the direction they're traveling and get them across safely, while at the same time being absolutely aware of your own safety. So slamming on the brakes on a busy highway to swerve off the road to move a turtle in traffic is probably not a great idea. A noble gesture, but you need to think of your own safety as well. So if you can help these turtles that are out and about, great. If you can't, well...
You can't.
You can't. If you can't, you can't. Don't put yourself at risk. Again, much like the other animals we were just talking about with Kent, they've been making these movements to find nesting sites for many years, and they continue to survive, although a lot of our turtles are not, although they're present and reasonably abundant, are still at some risk. And highway mortality is one of those factors. So, you know, do what you can to help out. Enjoy seeing them out. Don't grab them and take them home and say, oh, let's make this turtle a pet. Help them on their journey and then leave them alone.
Let's take another call. Mike in Kokana, your turn. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hey, this is I'd like to know what birds are prone to destroy each other's hatches.
Or break their eggs, yeah.
Well, there are a number. There are a couple of things that go on amongst different species of birds. Some are nest parasites. In other words, they will lay their eggs in the nests of other birds, and the most notorious of those are brown-headed cowbirds. So they'll lay their eggs in the nests of many different kinds of songbirds. When the cowbird eggs hatch, the young are aggressive and simply outcompete or literally push out of the nest the often smaller songbird nestlings. So those birds lose their annual production, or at least that brood, due to competition with cowbirds. There are other birds, wrens, for example, that are pretty aggressive that will actually damage or poke or break the eggs of some birds nesting when the wren decides it's going to occupy that nest cavity or nest box. There are some birds that lay their eggs. Some species of ducks will lay their eggs, especially the cavity nesters, in what's called a dump nest. And all of a sudden, you know, one bird may be raising a huge brood because she's got her own eggs, and then the eggs of another bird that left some there as well. So there are a number of different things that go on, some of which are detrimental to the host bird, but again, that's a strategy used by the wrens or the cowbirds or others that has worked over time.
Yeah. Mike, thank you. Appreciate it. Dawn in La Crosse, on to you. Hi, Dawn.
Good morning. Another great show, Larry. Love these wildlife shows.
Thank you.
Last week, I was driving about, maybe 30 miles southwest of Marshfield and saw some movement along the side of the road. Into the woods was a beautiful gray wolf. And I was pretty stunned. I even went online to look and make sure that's what I saw, and it was. It's just gorgeous. I'm just wondering, is that common for them to be this far south in the state?
Well, I'm not sure how to answer that, Dawn. The reality is that I'm pretty sure that wolves have been documented in virtually, if not every county, darn near every county in the state now. Even in the extreme south and even over on the shoreline in some heavily urbanized counties. And in some cases, these are animals that are dispersing considerable distances. We have records of Wisconsin wolves covering, in well off into other neighboring states. So what the animal was doing there or what its intentions were up for grabs, but it's certainly possible that someone would encounter or see a wolf in virtually any county. Now, when you get down into central Wisconsin, some packs are established in that area, not just restricted to the northern part of the state, any northern third of the state anymore. So there's certainly a higher probability of encountering a wolf in areas where packs are established. And you can look at the map of pack locations on the DNR website and find where you were on the map and look at that map of pack distribution and see where you were in relation to known packs and then go from there. But anybody has a chance to see a wandering individual or dispersing individual virtually anywhere.
Yeah, there you go, Don.
The tricky part, of course, is then making the distinction, oh, did I see a coyote? Or did I see a wolf? And that's another matter.
Yeah. Don, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Fred in Wisconsin Rapids, on to you now.
Hi, guys. I hope you enjoy this email story that my neighbor called very interesting. She is on a lake with us on Langford Lake in UP near Wakefield, Michigan. And she says, last evening around 7 p.m., I left the porch to get a drink of water. There was a bear busily demolishing the bear feeders. I grabbed the broom and went racing through the kitchen door, yelling madly and waving my broom. The bear dropped to all fours and went to the edge of the woods. We watched each other, but it was a standoff. I would go to the bottom of the steps, and he would back up a couple of steps. It is obvious he had no intention of leaving the food behind, so I did the only thing possible and grabbed the ultimate weapon, the trusty BB gun. I fired off a shot, and the bear ran racing behind the outhouse. I waited. Finally, he came out from behind the outhouse, and I fired another shot, and he went racing through the woods. Damages were minimal. One bird feeder post and two empty feeders on the ground. I think I won that battle. And then she says, this is a true story and thought you might enjoy it. And I think that I'm hoping that the listeners will enjoy this story.
Fred, thanks a lot.
I don't know that I'd be
out there with a broom or even a BB gun.
The classic battle between the angry homeowner and the hungry bear. But, you point out that, again, discretion is the better part of valor. And, bear is a big, powerful animal. And we were just discussing what happened to that couple in Medford when they started yelling at a bear that ended up, hey, I think I'll just go in the house after them. One should exercise a little caution when confronting a bear like that. And number two, from the bear's perspective, indiscriminately shooting at it with a BB gun, the BB's not going to do much. But on the other hand, the BB gun could blind a bear, at least in one eye, and that's not going to be a good thing. So, again, this situation seemed to end well, and it's a humorous story in a way, but there are a couple lessons to be learned on both sides of that.
Scott Craven, our guest today, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Jill DeDoz, our producer. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here taking a look at the world of wildlife with our guest Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist and Emeritus with UW Extension. Always fun to have him with us. And we've finally have some open lines again, so you can join in at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call from John in Madison next. John, hi. Thank you for calling.
Sure. Thank you for taking my call. I hike almost daily in the Pheasant Branch Conservancy, and there is, close to the hiking trail, a vernal, I've been told is a vernal pool. And it wakes up. And when it gets warm, what kind of creatures are in there that I may learn more about them? And how do they survive the winter?
In a small vernal pool.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, there are, in terms of occupancy of a pool, a woodland pool, it makes a great deal of difference whether they're permanent or ephemeral. And ephemeral ponds, small pools the size of a tabletop to the size of a garage or whatever, are very important in woodland systems as a water source for many animals, simply as a water source, but also as a breeding site, particularly for amphibians. And I mean salamanders and frogs and toads. And those ponds are very important, and the timing of the whole thing is usually keyed that the animals use those ponds for breeding in early spring, and then as the ponds dry up and shrink away, the frogs and salamander larvae have emerged from the egg. The larvae are maturing to the point that, hopefully, from their standpoint, at about the time the pond disappears in mid to late summer, those tadpoles or salamander larvae have metamorphosed into land-dwelling adults that leave the pond and go about their way as another generation to add to the population. Then the pond disappears. In the meantime, there are lots of other things that use the pond in terms of insects and other invertebrates. And, you know, studying pond study is the basis of, you know, just about every summer camp and youth camp when you get kids into a small pond with a net and then dump some things under a binocular microscope or a magnifying glass and look at all the creepy crawly stuff that's in there. And there can be hundreds, if not thousands, of species of invertebrates along with the frogs and salamanders. Now, if the pool is permanent, there's some water source from seepage or some little connection to Pheasant Branch Creek in the case of this pond that John is talking about, or spring or whatever, then it poses a little greater opportunity for species to colonize that little pool because the water is going to be a permanent source when it's not frozen. Those animals that have to deal with the freezing usually burrow down into the mud or overwinter in a variety of different ways. So a lot of different creatures have different strategies for overcoming winter freezing. But again, those little ponds, like John describes, are a source of abundant life and really neat things to study, especially for kids that are curious about little creepy crawlies.
Yep, absolutely. John, thank you so much. Terry in Roberts, Wisconsin, emailed to say she used to smell skunks all over when driving around evenings in the spring, and she rarely smells that memorable spring event these days. Wonders if skunk populations are down.
Well, there are a few species like skunks and possums and so forth where roadkill is a fairly common index to population abundance. And the issue, I guess, with skunks is that you don't have to see the dead individual. You usually know they're there by smell, which is what she's talking about. And I guess, as I think about it, as I've been traveling around, I've seen a few dead skunks on the road and occasionally caught a whiff of skunk odor. But I guess I'd agree with Gary that it doesn't seem like there have been as many as normal. But on the other hand, it was a bizarre spring. It was a lot of cold weather that slowed everything down, including animals that are tuned into warm periods, like possums and skunks, to get out and about and wandering around. So some of that activity that may lead to the smell she so fondly misses may be yet to come. As I mentioned when we started, Larry, I just returned from a couple weeks at our summer wildlife field camp up in northern Wisconsin, and the phenology, the timing of spring events was greatly delayed because of long persistent snow and cold and late ice out and so forth. So a lot of things that we would normally have expected to see and experience were simply pushed back. And that may be the case with skunk activity as well. And the fundamental question is, have I heard anything about a dramatic decline or any kind of a decline in skunk populations? And the answer is no. So be patient. You may still get a whiff of skunk and you'll be back in business.
Yeah, and you know, it did seem the frogs were a bit confused with our weather.
Well, the frogs have had a tough spring. They started way back in early March in my pond in the backyard here, started up, then it got cold, they quit and seemingly disappeared. Then they started up again, and then they quit, and then started, and then quit. And that's been going on now for the better part of 2.5 months.
Yeah.
And as a result, as we were doing, our students were doing some frog surveys up in northern Wisconsin, and there were still some fairly early spring singers that were still chiming into the chorus, like peepers. Wood frogs were long gone, but the summer frogs, green frogs, leopard frogs, bullfrogs, and so forth, had not gotten started. But yes, they've had some fits and starts as far as their calling and then breeding activity. But hopefully things will stabilize now. There is good water. Everybody's had rain. Some of our drought concerns have alleviated. So once they finally get going, and I notice there's thousands of toad tadpoles in my backyard pond right now. So things are underway in the southern part of the state and will be soon in the north. So,
Gary in Ween, Wisconsin, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Larry and Scott. Love your show. About 10 years ago, my wife and I were on a 25-day hiking camping trip to British Columbia and Alberta. She referred to it as a trip where it rained every day except when it snowed. But we had hiked up to this glacial cirque, and the last about 200 yards was across the meadow, and we went over the top of the cirque, sat back in there and had lunch, and we're just enjoying the beautiful view. And when we were coming back out over the wall of the cirque, here were two grizzly bears between us and the trail. And so we ducked back down, and we waited, and then it was getting later in the day, and we weren't equipped to spend the night up there because it would be very cold. And so I said, we'll make noise before they see us, and then I can't sing, but I can be fairly loud, and I start singing Bob Dylan's Just Like Tom Thumb's Blues. And we got up and started off to the left onto a scree field, and the bears were within 100 yards, and they were digging something. At one point, they'd gotten within 50 yards. My wife has beautiful photos of them. And after we made it across safely and were back into the woods and going down to where we had parked, I told my wife what saved us was they heard me sing, and they thought, whatever sounds that bad, can't be good to eat. So...
Well, that's another good bear story with a happy ending for all concerned. So,
thanks, Gary. Thanks a lot for that story. Oh boy, Alice in Prairie du Sac. We'll go to you. Hi, Alice.
Yes, hi. I'm wondering if what I'm doing is actually working, or you think I'm being lucky. But we have been fighting 13 line ground squirrels, which mm-hmm. are adorable until they dig under your cement for your porch. Mm-hmm. And a neighbor said that she deterred them with cat litter from the cat litter box that had been used. And we've used that this spring, and we haven't had any signs of them.
Ah. Why not?
Alice, I guess the bottom line is they're not there. So the cat litter may certainly have helped. There may be other reasons too, but the reality is that cat litter, of course, contains urine and feces from cats, and there are commercial repellents for mammal control based on big cat urine, like lion urine, which is collected and then used as an ingredient in commercial repellents. So there's something to what you're doing. And, this is one of those things where if it keeps working, keep using it. And it's probably a good way to get rid of used cat litter, too. But it does have some basis in commercial product manufacture. So I think that is probably as likely that your cat litter technique is working as it is that something else happened and the ground squirrel simply moved on. But 13 liners are a big pain in the neck around the home in terms of seed digging in the garden, excavating under patios and things like that. But, that's another animal. I'm thinking way back to our first call, as Sherry had the hole that something apparently moved in where there had been a bigger hole, and 13 liners are another possibility for her as well. But anyway, keep using the cat litter. And
yeah, cat litter, also some cat litters contain chemicals that have an odor that they may not like either, even regardless of used or not.
Yeah, I don't know what to say about that, Larry. In some cases, at least, the cat litter that you buy in large bags is an extruded clay product. And I was surprised when I was trying to create an overwinter frog situation in the little bog that's associated with the pond I just put in the backyard. And the landscaper said, well, you know, if you want the frogs to be able to overwinter, they've got to be able to snuggle down into something. And if you use dirt and mud and so forth, it's very messy. So he said, just get 50 pounds of cat litter and dump it in your little pond, which is about 4 feet wide and a couple feet, 2 feet by 4 feet, say. So I went out and got a big bag of cat litter. He said, it's great. It'll sink immediately to the bottom. It'll swell up, and it will never make the water look dirty. And sure enough, I dumped that whole bag in there, and it settled right through the clear water and formed this kind of porous mass on the bottom that the frogs used all winter and emerged again this spring, and it never affected the water clarity or quality at all. So
that is very cool.
Cat litter is a miracle product, used or unused.
Alice, thanks again for that question. Appreciate it. John emailed, he observed a crow take an infant rabbit, probably 4 or 5 inches long, from a green space on campus, very similarly to a raptor, kind of. And also his neighbor observed a sandhill crane destroying a rabbit hole in his yard.
Well, that's not a surprise at all. Crows will certainly do that and have the reputation for depredating nestling birds, small mammals, and so forth. So, and cranes as well. Many animals we kind of think of as being, they're benign, they don't bother anybody else, and so forth. But given the opportunity, most things will eat a lot of other things that we don't expect them to eat. And certainly a crow taking a baby rabbit is no surprise. A crane potentially doing the same thing if they encountered the young, or taking snakes or frogs or other things. We think of them as being an issue for pulling up corn seedlings in Wisconsin cornfields, but they eat a lot of different things. And, I think the best example of that related to the crane was actually a few years ago on the program. I ended up getting some pictures from someone who was watching a great blue heron walk up to their bird feeder from the lake, who would walk up on the lawn and stand stock still next to the bird feeder.
Yeah.
And just stand there. Do you remember this one?
Yes, I do.
They'd wait for a chipmunk to come along to grab a seed, and then whomp, they'd grab the chipmunk in their bill and go back down to the lake, drown it, and swallow it, just like that. And they learned that, hey, great source of food, lots of chipmunks, and they did it repeatedly. So anyway, don't be surprised at what you see in the wild. As the expression goes, it's a dog-eat-dog world out there.
Scott Craven, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in. Questions for Scott, I hope you'll call us at 1-800-642-1234 or email your photo or your question to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Speaking of photos, Marilyn emailed a photo of some turkeys. Beautiful shot of a gobbler and three hens, I think, in Douglas County. I have
the picture, Larry. I just called it up. Boy, that's a nice gobbler.
Yeah, it's a very nice gobbler. very nice picture. Thanks for sending that, Marilyn. Appreciate it very much. Stella in Sturgeon Bay has a story for us. Hi, Stella.
Hi. I just wanted to, the last time that you had a guest on talking about birds, very near the end of the show, somebody called in asking about the versatility of mockingbirds, how versatile they are as far as imitating other calls and songs and so on. And there wasn't time for me to call in. I just wanted to share. We went through the 1994 Northridge earthquake out in California. We were about 5 miles from the epicenter. And for months afterwards, mockingbirds were imitating the car alarms that went off during the earthquake and the aftershocks. And they did it very accurately. Great variety.
Oh, that's a great story, Stella. Thank you for that. Scott, that's an unusual story.
That is. But, you know, these birds have tremendous capabilities. You know, we think of a parrot, for example, say, hey, give me a cracker, for crying out loud. But, you know, that's the extreme. But around here, without mockingbirds to deal with, boy, blue jays are terrific mimics, too. And around my home, at least, it's common to hear what I think is a screaming red-tailed hawk. And I said, wow, he sounds like he's right here. But it's a blue jay mimicking a red-tailed hawk. So they're pretty capable as well. So, again, one of those great wonders of wildlife that attracts our attention.
Mm-hmm. Kel in Sugar Camp, we'll go to you. Hi, Kel.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two questions. One is, do dragonfly larvae, the helicobacter, can they survive in ephemerals, or do they have to have water all year round? And the second question is, I seem to have lots of leopard frogs in the grass all summer long. We have a lot of shady areas, and the grass is fairly long. And they have different background colors. Some are bronzy, some are bright green, some are yellow-green, some are ochre. But they seem to have the same spot pattern, so I just assume they're all leopard frogs. Is that a possibility?
Yes, as far as the leopard frogs are concerned, they come in a variety of base colors, from a beautiful lime green to a bronze yellow brown, but they'll always have the same blotched roundish circle pattern. The only other frog that we have that's spotted or marked like that is the far more unusual pickerel frog that has squarish spots. But yes, you can see if you caught a big bag of leopard frogs and started to sort them out, you'd find all sorts of color gradations, just like we see in gray squirrels and some other species. So they're all the same frog species, but variable colors. And Larry, I didn't catch the first species you mentioned about the ephemeral ponds.
Dragonflies.
Oh.
Larvae.
Yes, those two are another thing that you'll find in these ephemeral ponds, and the whether it's the larvae of damselflies, dragonflies, and so on. They're as far as the dragonflies are concerned, there are a lot of different species. The big ones, the really big ones, the green darners, actually migrate back into Wisconsin in the spring, and then the first generation of nymphs that we see are from those dragonflies that come back into the state. And then there are successive generations over the course of the season. And at least for those larger dragonflies, those nymphs are outstanding fishing bait,
yeah,
and often harvested for that purpose. But they're just another occupant of both ephemeral and permanent ponds. And they're carnivorous. They'll eat tadpoles and things like that. So they're just another creature in the mix there.
Cool.
All right. Kel, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Excuse me. Barbara in Grand Marsh, on to you now. Hi, Barbara.
Well, I have a big problem. I have a giant raccoon that comes and he raids my Oriole feeder. And then in the middle of the night, I say, oh, God, I forgot to bring the Oriole feeder in. I can't have him living here because my house is raised up, and he's going to make a nest underneath it. I used coffee grounds and ammonia, but that doesn't help.
Well, I feel your pain, Barbara. I went out to put some suet in my suet feeders this morning and realized, oh, wait a minute, I put two new suet cakes out yesterday. And from the mess under the suet feeder, it was clear we had a raccoon visiting during the night. And I'm not too happy about that either. But it's a very difficult proposition to deal with them once they've found easy pickings in the form of an Oriole feeder full of grape jelly or my suet feeders filled with suet. So I'm either going to stop feeding suet for a while or I'm going to catch the raccoon. And if you've got a big individual that you're worried about also being a problem under the house, I suggest borrowing, renting, or obtaining a really good-sized commercial have-a-heart or national or tomahawk live trap and follow the instructions on how to use it. They're very vulnerable to cat food as a bait or sardines, or marshmallows are very good, and the marshmallows with a little strawberry jam on them won't attract possums and skunks and whatnot as much. But anyway, catch that animal and get rid of him somewhere. Locate him somewhere where someone's willing to accept him on their property, and go from there. As far as your Oriole feeder is concerned, I'm not sure how you have it deployed, but he can obviously get to it. But a 30-pound raccoon is not as dexterous as a squirrel that can, you know, shinny on a wire or whatnot. So if you can raise your Oriole feeder or run it out on a line with kind of a pulley system, there's not going to be any way that the raccoon can get to it. So at least in terms of the Oriole feeder, there are ways that you can suspend that, making it basically safe from the raccoon. But if you're concerned about other future coon problems, I think you need to catch and remove the coon.
Yeah. Barbara, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. AJ and Mazamani, your turn. Hi.
Hello there. I just have an observation on sandhill crane. For the last, I would say, 10 years, I have two sandhill cranes that come to my backfield, and eventually there's a third, a young one. And I'm wondering if sandhill cranes return to the same breeding grounds every year, or is it just a coincidence that it's two different sandhill cranes?
Well, I think they certainly, like many birds, have the ability to navigate back to the basic area where they were raised. Whether you're seeing the same individuals every year or some of their offspring over time returning to the area is kind of up for grabs. But it certainly could be when you get to larger birds that have a life expectancy of numerous years, you know, something the size of a goose, for example, might live for 20 years or more. Most don't, but some do. Then there's the potential that you're seeing the same birds year after year. Even some of the smaller birds will return to the same yard, same bush. You know, I see things returning to the feeders and to the yard here, and it's I think it's human nature to wonder, gee, is that the same rose-breasted grosbeak, that male that's back at the feeder again? I wonder what he did all winter. That's just human nature, and in many cases it may well be the same bird, but you never know for sure unless they're marked distinctively or have a, you know, some type of a feather pattern or something else you can recognize. But it certainly could be, AJ.
Yeah, and sandhills live pretty long lives, or can.
Yes.
For sure. Much like geese. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Dan in Caledonia, Minnesota. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. So I've got a question about bobcats in the Driftless region. Last year, I had something grab one of our ducks outside of our poultry coop. And I was like, might be a fox. And I set a trap. And the next morning, I had a bobcat. And talked to the DNR because we cannot keep them here in Minnesota. We released it. And I ended up seeing another one, a much larger one on my property. And then talking with my neighbors, I'm just seeing a lot more of them and hearing a lot more about a larger population. Is that something that has been studied or documented in the Driftless?
Yes, Dan. I mean, bobcats have become much more abundant in the Driftless area down along the eastern side of Minnesota, the western side of Wisconsin. And it's well documented, it's well known, and the animals are being seen frequently. 20 or 30 years ago, a bobcat in the Driftless area was noteworthy. And wow, a bobcat in the Driftless region of southwestern Wisconsin. But now it's commonplace. And the folks out there, the DNR researchers who have been working with the Southwestern Deer Ecology Study and market capturing and marking some predators, were catching and marking lots of bobcats. And I'm not sure there's any population density figures available, but you're right in your observation that they've become more abundant. They have, and they're probably there to stay. And it was a natural phenomenon.
Dan, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. He'll be with us right up until 12:30. We are going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we will be back with Scott. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here taking a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. And if you have a wildlife question or comment, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. And you could send as well an email to ideas@wpr.org. And you could include a wildlife photo along with that as well. I would appreciate that as well. So we have an email from Laura that her husband, she and her husband were approached by a very young fawn on Sunday. It was very warm. It came out of the hiding spot and approached them, crying at us, licked their legs, tried to suckle. The fawn was not injured or dehydrated. Continued to walk around, even followed them into their backyard where it was shady and laid on the patio behind my chair, acting more like a puppy than a wild deer. Very unusual behavior, they thought. They assumed that its mother did come and pick it up overnight, as they have seen the doe and fawn in their yard many times thereafter. Are some fawns, deer, more interactive with humans than would be expected? They tried to ignore it so as not to get it too comfortable with humans, but it wouldn't leave them alone.
Well, I've certainly heard that or a similar story before, Larry, and some fawns, I don't know that they're necessarily conscious thought, but they've been left, and all of a sudden there's a large mammal close to them, and they may be hungry, nervous, whatever, and all of a sudden it's caution goes to the wind, and that must be mom, and they approach people. I've had that happen to me a couple of times. Once when fishing a couple of springs ago, my son and I were approached by, we were walking along the brush along the creek, and all of a sudden twin fawns, two little guys, came out of the bushes and literally, much like Laura described, came right up to us, and we're kind of licking at our pant legs and so forth and looking for attention, and we tried to move away and they simply followed us. So eventually we picked them up, put them back in the brush, and then got out of there as quickly as we could. And again, like Laura assumes that they went about their way and the doe eventually reunited with them and took care of them. And that's what everybody would hope for in that circumstance. So, yes, it does happen. Happened to Laura, happened to me, and it's probably happened to a lot of other people. But as is the case, this time of year, there are lots of encounters with baby animals, whether they're fawns or other things, and the fundamental guideline is try and leave them alone unless there's clear evidence that the mother was
dead,
is taken out of the mix, is dead. In the case of a group of ducklings huddled up under along a road curb, and mother duck got taken out by traffic, then that's a case where intervention is the only alternative. And that's another story in terms of what you might actually do in that circumstance. But with fawns and most of these animals, all of these animals, they're better off with their natural mother. And the situation may seem threatening, or it may seem like they're abandoned, but the odds are very much in favor of the fact that they're not abandoned and that the mother is going to return and take care of them. And therefore, intervention is not warranted and, in fact, can be detrimental, again, unless you're sure that mother's been taken out. So
there we go. Josh in Madison, your turn. Hi, Josh.
Hello. Sorry. We have a territorial robin hanging out near our driveway this year that keeps attacking its reflection in the cars and then defecating all over the cars. Is there anything we can do to try and deter that?
Well, Josh, the it can be a very frustrating problem and very messy. I've been there with that situation, but the more common situation is the robins attacking a window reflection in a house, and then we've talked about that many times on the program. With a car, you know, moving the car may help if you have an option for another site, if the car can go in the garage. Beyond that, the only thing I can think of that would put an end to it is to eliminate the reflection, and that might be as simple as, you know, not something you want to have to do every night, but this is, or for a long period of time, but this is a very seasonal contracted thing while the young are in the nest or it's protecting its nesting territory. So an inexpensive plastic tarp that could be draped over at least the top of the car to cover the windows and the mirrors would put an end to it completely. Bird netting might do the same thing, but that's very difficult to work with and snags on everything. So I, you know, something like a tarp covering, or I guess they make actual car covers for cars that are being storage for a while. Something like that would put a quick end to it, but would require a little effort.
Yeah.
Moving the car, putting it in a garage might help too, but it's something you kind of have to grin and bear it or deal with it until the robin gives this up for the season.
Josh, thanks. Appreciate it. Gianni and Montello, your turn.
Yes. Thanks, Larry. Scott, I'm wondering if you're familiar with one of our Wisconsin authors. Her name is Linda Godfrey. I believe she was a reporter in Elkhorn back in the early 90s. And she's from the Elkhorn area. I grew up in Lyons, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with perhaps one of her books or what she reported on in the 1990s, but she wrote a book called The Bray Road Werewolf. I'm wondering if you're familiar with this phenomenon going on in Walworth County. It seems to have reemerged. And outside of some preternatural explanation or some interdimensional portal, what could possibly be this animal that people are so commonly reporting to see?
Well, I'm not familiar with the book nor the author. I apologize for that. And I've not heard reports. Mind you, I've been way more out of the loop the last few years than I was when I was working full time, but I've not heard anything. Can you describe in place what some of these people report they're seeing? Is it a big animal, a small animal, a dog-like, cat-like?
Well, it seems to have canine features. Canine features as opposed to feline features. It is reported to be seen eating dead deer along the road, and from eyewitness reports, it moves on all fours and also on two legs, and it seems to be very strong. There have been pictures that have been taken of this animal, and it seems to stand over 6 feet tall and may weigh 250 pounds, is estimated by some some biologists who have looked at these photos. So it's almost like something out of Hollywood, yet it appears that a number of witnesses, and this has been going on now for several decades, periodically report seeing this creature. And some have said, well, perhaps it's a bear of some sort that has gone awry or losing its hair. But perhaps it's something that you might might want to look into. Linda Godfrey is her
okay.
And she's written on the subject quite extensively.
I will take a look at that out of curiosity, but I don't know what to tell you. A lot of people have seen Sasquatch too, so we don't have any hard evidence there. But there are even TV shows devoted to it. For something in the southern Wisconsin area, when you mentioned canine features and a bizarre-looking animal feeding on roadkill, I thought about a mangy coyote, which can have just a dreadful-looking appearance. But when you got me with the on two legs and 6 feet tall and 250 pounds, that's bigger than anything we have in the wild here, other than a bear, and a bear would not go unnoticed in that part of Wisconsin, no matter what its condition. So I
look it up, Scott, and let us know next time you're on.
I'll look it up and see what I think about it. But what I think about it is that this is in the realm of an urban legend, and we'll leave it at that for today.
Okay. Stay listening, Johnny, and couple of months, you may have another answer. Scott may have done some research on this, and maybe he's observed one himself by that time. There you go.
Yeah.
Keith in Roseville, Minnesota. Your turn. Hi, Keith.
Hi. I was bicycling in Pierce County last Friday and saw what I initially thought was a big brown snake coming down a tree, and then realized it was a fur bearer, and I'm pretty confident it was two fishers that were locked muzzle to muzzle. When they saw me, they dropped to the ground, and then it was a ravine alongside the lightly traveled road that I was on, and then 20, 30 seconds later, I saw one of them rapidly going down the other side of the ravine. I emailed the county, the DNR biologist assigned to that area, and he indicated that fishers have been extending their range and didn't seem surprised at all. So I was wondering about the guest's view on this.
Well, you got the information from the DNR manager, and I would support that. Fishers have been extending their range, and over the years, I've seen excellent pictures of fishers up in trees in Governor Dodge State Park, just west of Madison, in Columbia County, just north of Madison. So they're quite capable of long-distance movement and range extension. So, and big, dark, weasel-like, hunched-up animal with a long, bushy tail. If you saw what you saw, and the fact that you saw two together, whether they were squabbling with each other, chasing each other, involved in mating activity, who knows? But they eventually separated, and you got another look at them. So the notion that you saw fishers in Pierce County is not at all surprising. You got lucky and even saw a couple of them. So I'm not sure what more to add to that.
Yeah, thanks, Keith. Appreciate it very much. Speaking of expanding range of animals, Ryan in Eau Claire emailed. He's been reading about armadillos moving further north with milder winters, similar to possums in the past. He recalls having read about several incidental sightings in southwestern Wisconsin, Richland County, he believes, in the past 5 years. Any chance of an established population of armadillos in the next 50 years?
Well, I've learned in talking about these animals for many years, Larry, that you never say never. But, and 50 years is a long time. God forbid that climate change gets so bad that we're dealing with southern species moving in. So my short answer is, boy, it's pretty unlikely. The longer answer is, yes, there have been some incidental observations, primarily of dead armadillos, on highways in Wisconsin, and most of those, if not all, either were traced or could probably be traced to dead animals that may have fallen off of, out of, a cross-country semi, or practical jokers picking up a dead armadillo in Texas or whatever, and, hey, let's chuck this out on the road in Wisconsin and stir up some interest. I've not heard any reports of a live armadillo in Wisconsin, and they're still quite a ways south of us. But Ryan's right. They are moving north, just like cardinals move north, possums move north, and that progression from south to north can be traced through the literature over decades. And that's happening with armadillos, too. But they're a ways from us, and our area is not particularly conducive to their long-range survival. So who knows what will happen in the future, but I don't think they're here now.
Ned in Verona, your turn. Hi, Ned.
Hi, Larry. I had a fun bike ride between New Glarus and Monroe 2 weeks ago on the Badger State Trail. And on my way back from Monroe, up ahead, I could see an animal on the bike trail. And the closer I got, here it was a fawn. And it laid down right on the trail, kind of on the edge, but no cover around it to speak of. And it just played dead. It just laid there plain dead still. And I started, maybe 10 yards away from it. I got off my bike and took a video with my camera. And the closer I got, it just stayed there. And I just decided, this is really cute. But this is late in the afternoon, early evening. I wanted to get back to New Glarus and get home. And so it's like, I'd love to hang around with you and see if Mom shows up, but I know Mom's close. Mom's no best for fawns. And so I didn't bother it. I didn't touch it. I didn't do anything. And I moved away probably 10, 15 yards and turned around and looked back. And sure enough, the fawn had stood up and was walking off the trail down into the woods.
Nice story.
Good story, Ned, and you did the right thing and enjoyed seeing it, but left it where it was, and it moved off. And, I mean, people, you think about the odds, Larry. There are probably, over the last couple of weeks and for the next couple of weeks, depending on where you are in the state, there'll be literally hundreds of thousands of fawns dropped, hundreds of thousands. And so the likelihood of encounters, and a doe dropped one in my front yard a week and a half ago. My wife sent me a picture while I was up north. It was standing about 50 feet from the front door. So lots of people will encounter these things. In some cases, you'll encounter some that are literally only hours old, and the fawn itself has no prior experience to draw on. All they can rely on is instinct to stay put and stay still. And if you leave them alone, the odds are they'll be okay. But realize that, again, it's a cruel world out there, and a lot of them will not make it. They'll be picked up by coyotes or foxes or whatever.
Bears.
And bears. Bears are very effective predators on fawns. And that's the way. If that mortality rate was not high, yeah. We'd be deeper in deer than we are now. So anyway.
Well, as you've said in the past, we go in about a 3 week period from the lowest number of deer in the state to the highest number.
And that's correct. Yep.
Thanks, Ned. Appreciate it. Mike in Spring Green. Hello.
Hi there. Yeah. Hi, you guys. I got a question about wood ducks. About 4 years ago, I put up two kestrel boxes along the edge of our prairie on trees, and I didn't see any kestrels using the boxes. So this year I thought somebody told me I need to move the kestrel boxes kind of further into the prairie, more out in the open, not in the trees. And I stuck my ladder up against the first wood duck box. And kind of reached in and I felt all this down and a bunch of eggs in there. And sure enough, I looked and there was a wood duck nesting in there, 10 eggs and all this beautiful down.
Oh.
So I stuck a camera trap up, you know, to kind of watch the coming and going on an adjacent tree. And I only got one photo of a duck going in over the course of like 2 weeks. So I was wondering if maybe this was a dump box that you guys had mentioned earlier in the conversation today. And when do you think it would be safe for me to go and check to see if, you know, if these eggs are hatched or if they're just going to be rotting in the box or what I should do?
Well, I think it's an unusual site for them to select, but there's no accounting for taste in these animals. And again, like we've talked about several times during this program, it's the kind of unpredictable, whimsical behavior of these animals in terms of all the things they do that keep us interested. Why the duck picked that kestrel box, I don't know, but it apparently did. And the bottom line in terms of visiting the box, I assume it's got a hinge top or side so that you can check it out without just reaching in the hole. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. So, you know, ordinarily people who are managing wood duck boxes for wood ducks and visit them periodically to check the clutch size or the status of the brood or whatever, will do that without harm to the nesting wood duck. So, you know, I would say if you want to check it, how long has it been since you discovered it?
Oh, it's probably been a week now, week and a half.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like roughly a complete clutch. They may have a dozen or so. So you're still potentially a couple weeks from hatch and ducklings. And the ducklings won't stay in there very long. So I would stick with your camera trap for another week or so, see if you see anything else. And if you don't, go check it and see what's going on.
Yeah.
And, at that point, you'll know, and if the eggs are still there and untouched, then give it a couple more weeks, and at that point, the hatching period would have expired, and if you check it again and the eggs seem to be untouched and there's been no camera trap evidence, then you could clean the box and put it to other purposes.
Yep. There you go, Mike. Oh, just the last, I wanted to mention that we've got the free fishing weekend coming up this weekend, and we also have the National Trail Days on June 4th.
Yep, lots of things going on, Larry. Get out there. If you've never fished before, try it this weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. And the trails, you can hike those trails and use the parks, those trails for free as well on June 4th. Scott, always a pleasure. Do some research on those. That
werewolves. I'm on it, Larry.
Okay. Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. He'll be back in a couple of months and we'll do this again. Tomorrow, our experts from the Bureau of Consumer Protection are back to update us on the latest calling scams. Involving charity, lottery, utility scams. That's tomorrow on the Ideas Network from 11 to 12:30. In the meantime, thanks for listening and stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.